This is a CBC podcast. Take a trip around the world with As It Happens. From the complex headlines of the day to the weird and wacky, As It Happens brings you the story behind the story. Download the podcast at cbc.ca/as it happens.
From the Tidemark Theatre in Campbell River, British Columbia, it's The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, it's great to be here. My first time in Campbell River. Sure took me long enough. For those of you listening on the radio, Campbell River is on Vancouver Island, about halfway between the elegance of Victoria to the south and the rugged beauty of Port Hardy to the north. Town of about 30,000 people, Campbell River has a bit of both worlds. There's a pavement of malls with all the requisite box stores, but also a cozy main street where you can visit Coho Books, complete with a resident dog that regulars know by name. The pier, where you can get everything from ice cream to fish and chips. And of course, the Quinsome Hotel. We're all heading to the Quinny after the show. Campbell River begins, more or less, where the warm waters of the Strait of Georgia end and the chillier northern waters begin. An aquatic collision which suits salmon and has encouraged Campbell River to declare itself the salmon capital of the world. Every second person I meet wants to tell me this is where John Wayne used to fish. When he was in town, the Duke stayed at Painter's Lodge, as did Bing Crosby. These days, tourists famously come to Campbell River and rent wetsuits and swim with the spawning salmon. I prefer my salmon swimming in butter myself. But this is, after all, the West Coast. And because we're on the coast, this town, like all the BC coastal towns, is more moored to the shore than on it. The malls are relegated to the edge of town. The ferry dock is smack in the middle. I arrived by ferry. We boarded in foggy Prince Rupert and chugged down the protected waters of the Inside Passage, past soaring cliffs and eagles and pencil-thin waterfalls that spill into the channel with hobbit-like precision. It was an overnight trip, and every time we looked out our cabin's generous porthole, a porthole as big as a picture window, we were staring at a splash of dark forest or jagged rock that had us reaching for our cameras. It was, as ferry rides go, as good as it gets. And that is saying a lot. I've always favored ferries. Given the choice, I've always chosen them over bridges. And don't get me wrong, I love the watery way of bridges, or sensible bridges, bridges that allow you to see the water they stand in. But by design, a bridge tries to negate nature, tries to push over it, to make the crossing of water a negligible thing. A bridge is just a road that says, there's nothing in my way. A ferry says nothing more than, climb aboard and let's see if we can do this together. But it's more than that, more than just a crossing. A ferry is a poor man's cruise. Even if it's only a brief ride, even if it's only a cable-pulled ferry crossing a narrow river, the ride can give you everything a cruise can and for a fraction of the cost. Step onto a ferry and you step out of time. Before you know it, you'll find yourself loitering over the railing with nothing more on your mind than the wind in your hair, the water at your feet, and that duck there flapping over the water as low and as impossibly straight as a line drawn by ruler. A ferry ride is an instant vacation, guaranteed to slow you down. That too. The responsibility of the trip has been taken out of your hands. You are no longer here, but you're not there either. You've left the here, and God and weather willing, you'll soon enough be there. But until you arrive, you're watching the ducks. Of course, there's always the chance you won't make it. The thing about a good ferry ride is that, like all good adventures, it is brushed with the possibility of danger. The winds could blow, the seas could turn, the cable could snap, any number of things could happen. But there's this definite sense that even if things go seriously bad, you're still going to make it. Something you can't say about planes. If something goes seriously wrong in a plane, you have to reconcile yourself to the fact that you are probably not swimming to shore. I like it that there are no security checks, no assigned seats, no fussing. I like that the rules, or more to the point, the lack of them, harken back to a more casual time, before we got all tied up in seat belts. I like the social nature of a ferry. Unlike a train or a plane, I found it safe to talk to the guy who's standing beside me. I can always walk away. I have a deeper bond with my fellow travelers. We are, after all, literally in the same boat together. The other thing about ferries, of course, is that almost always when I'm on a ferry, I'm heading to a special place. I'm heading off the beaten path to some exotic backwater. If the destination was dull, there wouldn't be a ferry. But more importantly, if it was at the center of things, well, there wouldn't be a ferry either. All of these things, but something more too. I know each trip on the water is metaphoric in some profound way, and it works on me every time. It's something about the crossing of water, something about being on the water that brings up big feelings and questions. When I get on a ferry, the soundtrack turns all gospel-y. Well, for the next hour or so, we're going to sail away on a sea of story and music, a radio ferry ride. And when it's over, we'll all say our farewells, knowing we'll probably meet again, but never this way. So let's make the most of what we have. Let's watch ducks together. Let's get going by getting to some music. You may have already heard today's musical guest perform on the show. He's a good friend of the Vinyl Cafe. We like him a lot, and we're not the only ones. This year, he went down to Memphis, Tennessee, to the International Blues Challenge, and he took home first prize as best solo artist. And that was an international challenge, too, so that's best in the world, right? Delighted he's with us today, and delighted he's going to start us off by singing a song that is exactly the kind of tune I was talking about a minute ago. It's a song about a train, but it's a metaphoric train. It could just as easily be a ferry boat. This is my friend Matt Anderson with a tune by the late Curtis Mayfield. This is People Get Ready.
Just thank the Lord. Ooh, sinner who trade all mankind just to save his own. Have pity on those whose chances go thinner. There's no hiding place among the kingdom's throne.
Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, they have to be short stories, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. We'll read everything you send us, and we'll read some of our favorites on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we'll send you a copy of the Vinyl Cafe Notebooks. We have one today from Bob Fairweather of West Vancouver, British Columbia. "Dear Stuart," writes Bob, "in May of 1975, I was a young single foreign service officer who had just been assigned to the Canadian Embassy in Japan. Shortly after my arrival in Tokyo, Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip paid a state visit to the land of the rising sun. In celebration of this momentous occasion, members of the Commonwealth were invited to a party in Shinjuku Gardens to meet the Queen and the Prince. When my official invitation arrived at the embassy, it said, 'Bob Fairweather and guest.' Being new to the city, I didn't have anyone who fit the bill. But there was a young lady named Sachko who I had spoken to several times at a restaurant close to my residence. She spoke good English, so the next time I saw her there, I asked if she'd like to accompany me to meet the Queen of England. She readily agreed. On the day of the party, I picked her up at the train station. She looked lovely in a fashionable spring outfit. We managed to stand close to the Queen herself during the afternoon event and exchange a few pleasantries with the Prince during their walkabout. Following the garden party, a number of us Canadians got together and went for dinner. About a week later, I received a phone call from one of those Canadians. He told me to turn on my television to Channel 10 quickly. It was a late night show, and a show definitely designed for adult viewers. I saw a young woman in an advanced state of undress. "Isn't that Satchko?" he asked. I had to admit, it certainly looked a lot like her. Well, it turns out it was her. And I soon learned that Satchko was one of Japan's leading stars of adult entertainment. From thereafter, I became known as that young diplomat who introduced the Queen of England to the Queen of the Night. Story came to us from Bob Fairweather of West Vancouver, British Columbia. We're going to get Matt Anderson up here to do another song now. Matt Anderson. was Matt Anderson. That song's off his album, Live from the Phoenix Theater. Matt Anderson. And it just keeps getting better and better. John Sheard's going to play the piano for you now. Was John Sheard, and that was El Condor Pasa, and that's on John's album, Firmament. And that was Dennis Pendrith playing the bass with John. Just as redemption can only come to those who have lost their way, just as true love only embraces the love lost, so, too, are dreams handed out. Oh, yes, they come to those who have hitched their wagon to a star, but even stargazers have a lost and a longing. For before you can dream, you have to long. And before you can long, you have also had to have lost. For 10 years, Dave's neighbor, Eugene, now well into his 90s, all spotted and brown with age, has spent his summers sitting in his backyard garden, tipping back precariously in his old kitchen chair, a little cigar in one hand and a tumbler of his famous homemade wine on the table in front of him. And with a dreamer's eye, he's watched over his garden, over the sticky grapes hanging in the shade of the grape arbor, over the languid eggplant and the waxy peppers, over the fattening red tomatoes and the promise of sweet corn. But more than anything, over the fragrant and silvery bed of rosemary that grows in the sandy soil by his shed. Sometimes in the impatient afternoon, he struggles up and makes his way back there. He grabs the stalk of the rosemary, crushes some of the precious needles between his rough fingers, and inhales the resiny aroma of lemon and pine. The scent always transports him to the hills of Calabria, back to the dusty little town of Rondi, where he grew up, to the farm where the dreaming began. It's been like this for 10 years. For 10 years since he planted it, Eugene has watched over his rosemary patch like a fretting uncle. He prunes the bushes every fall, covers them for the winter, feeds them from the big dusty bag of fish meal in the spring, and then dotes over them in the summer. Maria, his wife of over 70 years, learned many years ago that if she wants some fresh rosemary for a chicken she's roasting or a bread that she's baking, that she should not go out there with her shears and take it. Eugene has made it clear that the rosemary bush is not meant for her kitchen, not for her stove, not for her oven, not for the bottles of oil that line the window, infusing the sun. If she needs some, she has to wait until the old fool is napping. Even then, she's careful to snip from the middle of the bush so he won't spot that she's been there. Eugene sits in his chair and watches over his rosemary patch like an old cat, all sleepy and languid looking, but watchful all the same. He sits and watches, and while he watches, he dreams. This summer, his dream came true. "Sam!" It was more a whisper than the command he meant it to be. At 90, Eugene doesn't so much order as beseech. "Sam!" There was barely enough oxygen on this heavy August afternoon to breathe, let alone carry the old man's voice across the yard and over the fence. Barely audible over the electric buzzing of the cicadas, he called a third time. And this time, Dave's son, Sam, lost in the torpor of his own summer dreams, looked up and saw the old man waving at him impatiently. "Come here." Last summer, Sam would have walked around, out his yard and across the driveway. But this summer, long of leg and coltish of mind, he vaulted over the fence, pleased with his own grace as he jumped. "Sam," said the old man. He was too caught up in his dreams to be impressed by the flight of boy over fence. He was waving his cigar so close to Sam's face that the smoke stung the boy's eyes. "Sam," said Eugene, pointing, "what do you see?" He was staring at Sam with, well, almost indignation, as if the boy was about to tell him there was nothing to see, that he was imagining things. Sam followed his gaze to the back of the garden. "Flowers?" said Sam, uncertain of what it was he was supposed to notice. "What else?" said Eugene, who sounded urgent, almost frantic. Sam had never seen him like this before. "The shed?" said Sam, peering back there, puzzled. "No, no, no," said Eugene.
The flowers. The flowers. What else about the flowers?
They're blue, said Sam. And white? The old man was shaking his head. Not that, not that. Not the color of the flowers. I don't know what you're asking me, said Sam.
What else do you see, said Eugene, in the rosemary? What do you see in the rosemary bush?
Bees, said Sam. There are bees in the rosemary.
Bees, said Eugene.
And he slumped into his chair, his eyes closing, exhausted.
Honey bees,
he whispered. This was the moment he had been waiting for. This is what he'd been dreaming about. Rosemary honey. The old man's eyes were still closed. He was breathing fast.
Mr. Conte, said Sam.
He was getting a little scared.
Mr. Conte, are you all right?
It was so long ago. So long ago now, the memory was like a black and white movie, all flickering and faded in his mind. His grandfather, the path up the sun-soaked hill, the hot summer wind, the tree with the strange carvings, marks his great-great-grandfather had cut into the trunk, marks that claimed that tree and its honey for their family. He thought of them often these days, the buzzing of the bees, the puffing of the smoke pot, clouds of smoke under a cloudy sky, all gone cloudy in his memory. The camera of his mind panned from the tree onto his grandmother in her kitchen, her black apron and dress, the yeasty smell of homemade bread, the salty tang of fresh goat cheese, and on the rough kitchen table, the very table he had in his own kitchen today, the famous jar of honey, rosemary honey. In all his life, nothing had ever tasted so clean, so fragrant, so flower-like. The old man opened his watery eyes. He looked up at Sam.
I need your help, he said.
He was holding his arms out. Sam bent down and Eugene grabbed onto him and pulled himself out of his chair. And they walked to the end of the garden, the old man and the boy. And when they got there, they stood in front of the rosemary patch. And Eugene pointed at the bees.
Follow them. Find out where they go.
How do you follow a bee? How do you follow a bee along a bee line?
To follow a bee, said Eugene, you must think like a bee.
How do you think like a bee, said Sam. Eugene! It was Maria.
I will tell you tomorrow. Now go, go.
And he waved his hand in the air dismissively. When Sam came back the next afternoon, he brought his friend Murphy with him.
I told you not to tell anyone,
said Eugene. This is my friend Murphy, Mr. Conte. You've met him before. We can trust him. He's going to help us. Murphy nodded. Eugene looked Murphy up and down. Murphy took off his glasses and wiped them on his shirt. It's a move Murphy believes makes him look smart.
Sit down, said Eugene.
Both boys sat down at the table. Turns out following a bee is not a complicated business.
It's very simple, said Eugene. I've done it myself in the old country.
They would take a plate.
Like this one.
Eugene was holding a plate in front of him. They would cover the plate with honey. Eugene picked up the spoon that was in front of him on the table and dipped it in the jar of honey that Maria had brought him. He held the spoon over the plate.
Not too much, he said. Just enough.
Then they would set the plate with the honey on the ground
by the rosemary bush. And this is the important part. You have to watch it carefully.
When he said this, his right eyebrow crawled high on his forehead, like a caterpillar. The boys watched it, mesmerized.
The bees will come to the plate and eat. And when they are full, they will fly back to their hive.
The boys would sit and watch. And they would move the plate along the line the bees were traveling on, the bee line. They would be like pawns on a chessboard. They would follow the bees back to their hive, one move at a time.
I'd do it myself if my legs weren't so old.
Then Eugene reached into his pocket and pulled out his package of miniature cigars.
Smoke?
Both boys shook their heads. Eugene shrugged. He was trying to thank them. They didn't seem to care. They started the next morning. It took them 5 days to find the hive. Every day, inching their plate of honey through the neighborhood, down the street past the Turlington's house, along the alley behind Lawler's Drugs. It made them feel important. Even better, it made them feel old. They each took a book with them, and they pretended to read their books when people walked by them. They were, after all, working undercover. They were, after all, sworn to secrecy. One afternoon, the bees that had been flying away from them were suddenly flying towards them. "We've overshot," said Murphy. "We've gone too far." So they backtracked, and they found the hive in a tree on the edge of the park. There was a hole in the tree as round as a baseball bat, and there were bees everywhere, circling the tree with the certainty of summer.
"That's it," said Murphy.
"We found it," said Sam. "In a tree," said Murphy. "In the park," said Sam. Eugene smiled. He didn't think they'd have the patience.
"You're sure it's the right one? These ones?"
And he gestured towards the bees on the rosemary bush. "We followed them," said Sam. "We're sure," said Murphy.
"Take me to the shed."
They helped him up. And they walked beside him to the back of the garden and into the cool, damp garden shed. And he stood by the door and told them what he wanted them to do. And they did as they were told. They pulled wooden boxes off the shelves. They pawed through the boxes until they found what he was looking for. It looked like a lantern with a spout. It was his great-grandfather's smoker. He sent them off to gather twigs. He got them to soak pine needles in water. He taught them how to light it. And once it was going, he told them that they were going to pretend that the doorknob on the shed was the hole to the hive.
Back and forth," he said as they snuck up on the shed,
smoke pouring out of the smoker's spout.
"Slowly," he said. "Slower," he said. "Move like the priest with the thurible."
They both stopped and looked at him. "Like what?" they said.
"Never mind. Never mind. Just go slowly. Don't excite them. Slower. Let the smoke do the work. It puts them to sleep. No, not yet. Not yet now. Now you can reach in, but not too fast. You don't want to make them mad. Slower than that. Okay, now you're in. You feel for the honeycomb. You take just a bit. The top layer. You take yours. You leave them theirs. Half and half. That's fair. It's important to be fair always, especially with bees."
He was afraid he was asking too much of them. If they made a mistake, if they went too fast, if they used too little smoke, if they panicked, if any number of a thousand things went wrong, a bee sting is no joking matter. It's like having your finger slammed with a hammer. And when you are fighting bees, there can be too many fingers, too many hammers. Why weren't they back? They'd been gone over an hour. Surely it shouldn't take an hour. It took two. 15 minutes to get the honey, and an hour and three quarters to get their nerve. They spent the first hour and three quarters staring at the tree, studying it, considering it, arguing about it. They stared and they studied and they argued for an hour and three quarters, and then they moved in. They decided Murphy would work the smoker and Sam would stick his hand in the hive. "He's your neighbor," said Murphy. It went off without a hitch. And now they were back. They were standing in front of him, standing beside his picnic table. All three of them staring at the dripping piece of honeycomb lying on the newspaper on the table. It was the size of a bread plate. "Don't we have to wash it or something?" said Murphy. Beside the honey, there was a bottle of Eugene's homemade wine. And beside the wine, three wine glasses. Eugene picked up the bottle and opened it with great ceremony. It was from 7 summers ago. His best year ever. He poured out 3 glasses of the dusty, brick-colored burgundy. Then he picked up his glass and held it in the air in front of the boys.
"Grazie," he said.
Murphy picked up his glass and held it up in the air and cleared his throat and stared directly at Eugene and said, "Cent'anni." "You should live for 100 years. Sam looked at Murphy and whispered, "Where did that come from?" "The Godfather," said Murphy. And the two of them dumped their wine on the ground. As if she'd been waiting for a cue, Maria Conte came out the basement door carrying a large wooden tray. There was cheese on it, a bowl of coarse sea salt, a loaf of homemade bread, and a dark green bottle of olive oil. "Mangia," she said, "mangia." Everyone watched Eugene. No one said a word. He chewed, and he chewed, and they waited. And slowly, slowly, ever so slowly, he began to grin. A hive of bees is like a kitchen at harvest. They gather up the summer, the heat of the sun, the warmth of the rain, the softness of the mornings and the long afternoons. Above all, they gather up the flavors of the flowers. They gather it all up and mix it together and cork it in wax.
"Bene," said Eugene. "Bene, bene. Bene."
There was a tear running down his cheek.
"You did a good job," he said. "I wish I went with you. I should have gone."
Sam looked at Eugene for a moment, and then he stood up and said, "We'll be back in a minute." "Come on," he said to Murphy. They were longer than a minute. But when they came back, they were pulling Sam's old wagon. They set it up by the picnic table, and then they helped Eugene get out of his chair and into the wagon. And off they sat. He sat there holding the sides tightly, all hunched over. Each time he saw someone walking towards them, he straightened up. He straightened up and sat as straight as he could, staring straight ahead as they passed, just daring them to say something. They followed the beeline. They followed the beeline that they had followed all week, or they followed it as best they could. And as they did, they showed him the way it had been. "They come over that fence," they said. "They come through those trees." They stopped 5 yards from the tree in the park. And they stood there, and they stared. After a few moments, Eugene began fussing with his coat. He was looking for something. When he found it, he held it out and smiled at the two boys. A leather sheathed knife. A knife that had once belonged to his grandfather. He held his arms out the same way he had held them out the week before when he had called Sam and Sam had vaulted over the fence. He said,
I want to mark this tree with my family mark so everyone will know it is our tree, our honey.
Sam helped him up and over to the tree. When he got there, Eugene leaned against the trunk, but he couldn't manage the knife. He tried, but he wasn't strong enough. He leaned against the tree for a moment, breathing fast, and they waited until he handed Sam the knife.
You do it.
Sam took the knife and said, I don't know how to make the Conte mark. And Eugene shook his head.
No Conte mark. Your mark, Sam. This tree is your tree.
Last summer, Sam would have been scared to cut into the tree, unsure of what you were allowed to do to a tree in a park. A few years from now, he'll not be around for the old man to call. But this summer he was around, and he was the perfect age for the command. So while Eugene waved the smoke machine, Sam and then Murphy carved their initials 6 inches above the entrance to the hive. They are not perfect. Sam's S looks like an 8, but you can tell what it is if you're foolhardy enough to get close. The bees will live in that tree for many years, yeah? The boys will never take honey again. But Sam will come back every year and look at the mark, even after the bees have left. And he will remember this moment always, this moment standing by the tree holding the knife just after he's used it. He will remember that moment, and he will remember the moment in Eugene's backyard, eating the honey, and how it was both sweet and bitter all at once, how it burned his throat. He will remember these things, but most of all, he will remember how he and Murphy spent a week of this past summer on the trail of bees. Thank you. Sit down. You can sit down. Thank you very much. Well, sadly, we've come to the part of the show where it's time for us to say goodbye. Before we do that, I just want to thank the people who are on stage with me today. Dennis Pendrith on the bass. John Sheard on the piano. Matt Anderson. Well, before we go, there's one last thing I want to do. I want to sing one last song with you. And I chose this song. I chose the song especially because I know the words to it, and everybody else on stage does. And I figured if we all knew the words, you probably knew the words too. And I thought it'd be fun if we all sang along together. Are you up for that? Would you do that with me? Okay, thanks. Okay. You guys ready? Here we go. Let's take her home.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
Wait, hold on a second here. Hold on a second. Now, I saw a number you were singing, and I heard a number you were singing, but I also saw what happened there where I invited you all to sing. I saw how you got elbowed up there, and how someone turned to you and said, "He doesn't mean you." Well, I do mean you. I mean each and every one of you. And Matt, just kind of to lead the way here, I was wondering if you could reach down deep. Just show everybody how it can be done. I want shivers running down everybody's spines. Can you do that for me?
I'm gonna have to.
Okay, away you go.
The other night, dear, as I lay sleeping,
oh, yeah.
I dreamed I held you in my arms. When I awoke, dear, I was mistaken. So I hung on my head and I cried.
Okay, everybody.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine.
Good. Now, before we go, there are a few more people I want to thank. I want to thank Ron Skinner, Brad Scrutton, and Bill Harold for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean in Campbell River, and this is your last chance to sing.
Sunshine, my only sunshine.
You make me happy.
When
skies are gray.
You'll never know, dear,
how much I love you.
Please don't take my sunshine away.
Okay, big finish.
Please don't take my sunshine away.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.